All right, so welcome. My name is Brian, as George has said, and we're going to be doing a quick, well, not quick, OpenBSD crash course. Is anybody here never heard of OpenBSD before? No one. Okay. Does anybody use OpenBSD on a daily basis? One, two, three. All right, so those of you who use it every day, a lot of this stuff may seem familiar to you, but towards the end, I'll be going over stuff that is new and coming to OpenBSD. So just quick overview, what is it? That's what we spend most of our time on. What's going on now? What's going on in the future? And really the point of this talk is to get you to ask yourself, why, you know, in 2014, is OpenBSD the choice for you? And like George said, ask questions now, while I'm talking, after I'm done talking, whatever. All right, and then who am I? I'm an OpenBSD developer. My 1 year anniversary from getting my account was yesterday, so yay me.
Woo!
I do ports. My invitation actually came from doing port cleanups on our MIPS 64EL architecture. That's long some tiny little MIPS laptops. I'm also the guy responsible for building OpenBSD Octeon 5.4 release binaries and snapshots. I generally make one every month. If anybody has any Octeon boxes, those are all another MIPS box. Last year in April, I gave a talk, MIPS on OpenBSD. It's on the website. You can grab it, listen to it. And I always like to say this, I'm not a CS person. It's not what I'm educated in. And I always like to say that, anybody can do this. You know, if I can do it, I can get up here, I can talk about what I do, then anybody can get involved in OpenBSD and anybody can contribute if they want to. I'm also an admin at Devious. We're an OpenBSD shell provider, so anybody on the list who sees my email address and wonders where that comes from, that's where that is. And if you really like me so much that you want to find out more, I keep a Gopher site, because yes, it's still 1992. And you can see all the stuff that I do on there. And Gopher's easy to get to. You just run links. It's on the base install of OpenBSD. So if you're running OpenBSD, you can already learn all about me. So, what is OpenBSD? This is a list of people, a list of things that people who I ask what OpenBSD is and they don't know, generally tell me. Either it's that firewall OS, or it's a bunch of crazy paranoid security people. Or they say something like, I read an email from them once, and they're all mean. None of this is necessarily true.
I was gonna say, isn't that all true?
Maybe. Depends who you talk to. So if you run OpenBSD and you have a very lazy sysadmin, your default Etsy message of the day says, welcome to OpenBSD, the proactively secure Unix-like operating system. And that's a great one-line what we are. Our website says that the OpenBSD project produces a free, multi-platform, 4.4 BSD-based Unix-like operating system. Our efforts emphasize portability, standardization, correctness, proactive security, and integrated cryptography. And our big slogan that's in red, only two remote holes in the default install in a heck of a long time. And this is important way beyond the obvious, we don't have security holes. And OpenBSD is really for developers by developers. We make the operating system that we ourselves want to use. And the users who like it get to come along on the ride. But there's no confusion, we're the ones who are essentially piloting the ship. So free, what does free mean in this day and age of free software and whatnot? Free to us is BSD licensed. As per our goals.html page, acceptable copyright for code to be put into our base system is ISC or Berkeley style preferred, GPL acceptable as a last recourse but not in the kernel, and that actually should be updated. GPL 3 is an absolute no-no, and NDA is never acceptable. As of 2003, so just about 10 years ago, we changed the ISC license as our preferred license for new code. That's the ISC license. It fits on one slot. It's really short. Basically, don't claim that you wrote this and leave our copyright. And don't sue us. That's about it. Yeah.
As a BSD, what's the relationship with the ISC license?
So the ISC license, as far as I understand it, I'm not a lawyer, it's the two-clause BSD license with redundant verbiage removed. So it's effectively the same as a two-clause BSD license. So what is an operating system, especially people coming from the land of that other free software OS? We are not a kernel. We are a kernel and a user land. We are everything. OpenBSD is one package. You install it, and it's all from the same team. Like I said before, we have no NDA code. So a lot of times people like to complain that we don't support everything. And maybe that's true. But if a vendor won't release documentation, and nobody wants to reverse engineer it, then it's not going to be supported. And that's our stance on the matter. So, of course, if you want stuff to be supported, you know, always, always, always politely contact vendors, get them to release documentation, because it helps everybody. It doesn't just help the OpenBSD project. You know, the more software we get out there, the more devices we get to support, the more everybody benefits. We have no blobs. There's nothing binary in OpenBSD. And we want people to use our code. You know, it's there so that it can be used. Use what you need or use everything. So what is portability? We have 21 supported platforms over 14 architectures. And that's the whole list of architectures and platforms. Some of that stuff everybody has seen before, your AMD 64 laptops, your i386 machines, your Macintosh powered PCs. You know, we still support the Baxes from, you know, way, way back. Some things probably some of you guys have never heard of, like the Luna 88K. As far as I know, it's a Japanese computer. They're running off of Motorola 88K processor, which I've never even seen before. So we support a ton of stuff. We have two what we call current porting efforts. It means that people are trying to get them to be supported platforms, but it doesn't necessarily mean people are actively working on them at the moment. And then we have 8 discontinued platforms with the release that they were removed from the tree listed. So your Amigas are gone, ARCs, which were a MIPS machine, CATS, which was an ARM machine, the old 68K Max, as much as that breaks my heart, Palms, Pegasus, PMAX, and Sun 3. And the big thing that we do, especially in contrast to NetBSD, is there's no cross-compiling. Every single supported platform builds its own binaries. And I can tell you, as the guy who built the Octeon release and continues to build Octeon snapshots, I have a machine that all it does is sit there and build OpenBSD. That's its job, is to build OpenBSD so I can get the new set of binaries out for people. What else do we do? Standardization. So for us, that means adherence to POSIX and ANSI. This comes up a lot on our IRC channel on NiceBug, really long flags. There's none of that stuff. Flags are a letter. And documentation. Documentation is huge for us. Correctness. So hacks are discouraged. Our motto essentially is do it the right way or don't do it. There's a constant auditing of the source tree, and again, no NDAs, no blobs, and documentation. The documentation has to be correct. It's not enough just for the code to be correct. Proactive security. So what if you install OpenBSD? What's going to be on when you reboot? SSH. And if you install with a new user, we disable root for you. So you can't even log in SSH as root. And if you really want it, NTP. But you have to say yes to that question. And we use OpenNTPD. We don't use any other. We use our own version of NTPD, which is, of course, as always, coded with security in mind. Again, no NDAs, no blobs. This is kind of like a point. Everything is free. Everything is available for you to use. And cryptography. And essentially, in today's world of script kiddies and other nonsense, do you really want to start the machine's life with a bunch of security problems? How many people here today in 2014 unplug their computers and pull out your Wi-Fi cards before installing an operating system? Probably no. You do? Because I don't. I install my operating system over the internet. Really quick and really simple. And this way, I know that once I get back up, if I have to walk away or something, I'm not going to come back to a host box. And also today, you know, with virtual machines and whatnot, where you can't even control whether or not the machine is online. So no blobs, because I've said this a whole lot of times. The theme of the 3.9 release was blobs. And this is our stance on blobs. They can be desupported at any time. They cannot be supported by developers because we have no idea what the code looks like. They can't be fixed by developers because we have no idea what the code looks like. They can't be improved because we have no idea what the code looks like. They can't be audited because we have no idea what the code looks like. They're specific to an architecture, and that's really important for me as somebody who deals a lot in the not x86 platforms. That no one's going to build a blob for a small little Chinese laptop with a little Endian MIPS processor on it. It's just not going to happen. And the blobs are often quite massively bloated, and we have no idea what's going on inside them. So if something malicious is going on, we have no idea, no way to fix it. And once it's in your kernel, it's already game over. Like, you've already lost. So you should not have blobs. And we don't. We have extensive documentation in our manual pages and our FAQ. And we are always referring new users and people with questions to read these things before they ask questions. Because your question, especially if you're new, is almost certainly answered. And it's a serious task. You know, a mistake in the documentation, as far as we're concerned, is a bug, just like it would be a bug in the code. New programs must have a manual page when they're imported. So we're not going to have something that's in the tree, then 8 months later someone says, what the hell does that do? Once it's in the tree, you can look up what it does and you can read the manual page. This actually just happened a few days ago, I'll talk about it later. We just imported a new program and part of the import was a manual page. Good documentation lets users solve problems quickly, and that is why we continually point to the FAQ and to the man pages when new users have questions. Because we've answered them, you look it up, you go about your day, and it saves everybody time. It saves you time of having to ask the question and wait for somebody to answer. It saves us time to write more code and not have to answer. And good documentation also lets programmers write better code, and that's a positive feedback loop. You read good documentation, you write good code, you write good documentation on your code. Somebody else reads your documentation, then they write good code. And so somebody else reads their documentation, and on and on and on. We want to promote good code, because there's a lot of bad code out there. But proactive security, this is just a quick list. I'm not going to talk about all these things individually, because there's a whole lot of places where you can see much more in detail about this stuff. WXRX, guard pages, privilege separation, privilege revocation, CH root jailing, ProPolice, which is in GCC, sterile copying, sterile cat, I'll talk a little bit about those two a little bit later, and swap encryption in small chunks. You don't encrypt your entire swap, you encrypt little chunks of swap. So privilege separation, this is taking Theo, who's our project lead. He gave a talk recently at EuroBSDCon. The first PrivSlab application was PostFix, that's not one of our programs, but the second one was OpenSSH, and now everything does it. And Theo even went so far to write that if an OpenBSD developer writes a daemon which doesn't use this technique, they'd be left straight into another project. Like everything else in FAR security is concerned, we take it seriously. And on the topic of privilege separation, we actually got a recent shout out. If anybody has been watching the 30C3 videos, which I highly recommend because they're all incredibly interesting, I hope I pronounced his name right, Ilya Van Sprindel, he gave a talk on X-Security titled X-Security, It's Worse Than It Looks. He chronicled his time looking through the X server and X client and just finding really old, bad bugs and then just submitting a whole bunch of bug reports and fixes. He actually says, I'm going to quote him, he says, the OpenBSD guys did this at least 5 years ago, maybe longer, and the XOR guys should just steal the OpenBSD code and be done with it. The OpenBSD guys know how to do privilege separation. Just get their code, use it. That was in reference to X not having privilege separation in 2014. To which I might add, the whole crowd gave a nice big round of applause. That was kind of nice to hear. And his slide actually says, the whole X server runs in root. There's been some talk about implementing PrivSep PrivDrop. He mentioned Solaris kind of sort of talking maybe about doing it. But then I like the last 2 points. He says, as far as I know, no one has done this. And immediately afterwards, he says, OpenBSD did it. So he knows someone who did it. OpenBSD did it. So integrated cryptography. Why? Mostly because we can. OpenBSD is based in Canada. It was founded in 1995. This was back in the time where it was much more difficult to export cryptography out of the United States. And even to this day, we still ask that people who are outside the US not get OpenBSD from the US, just to be safe. So what uses it? Pretty much everything. OpenSSH uses it, obviously, because it's SSH. And pretty much the entire system uses cryptography in some way. We're also big with our pseudo-random number generators, and if anybody's running Current, this hit in October, we've replaced the RC4 stream cipher with ChaCha20, because if you've been reading the news, there's been news reports that the NSA might be able to reliably break RC4, which is really bad for everybody. But we've already moved on. If you're running Current, you know, you're already using something different. Question?
No.
So we release every 6 months, May 1st, November 1st. Every year, you know when it happens. We put pre-orders out for our CD sets in advance, so everybody knows when it is. Every single release has its own theme, which includes artwork and an original song. For 5.4, it was Sound of Music, which is actually kind of fun. The song is really good. We officially support whatever our current release is and the previous release. So that's 5.4 and 5.3. And when 5.5 is released on May 1st, we drop support for 5.3, and it becomes 5.4 and 5.5. And again, you know, because it's so regular, users can anticipate this stuff. There's not going to be a question, oh, when's the next version of OpenBSD going to be released? It's going to be released 6 months from the last one. So you know when you have to upgrade. And our upgrade officially supported from release to release. We don't do big jumps. That's because unlike a lot of other projects, ABIs, APIs will break on every single release. So it just gets to be incredibly difficult the farther back you go. So if you want to do a big jump, we just recommend a fresh install. And the OpenBSD install takes 3 minutes, so we're not asking for a lot of your time. So I was going to bring my own copy of the 5.4 release set. And of course that means because I practiced it, because I wrote it down, I forgot to bring it. Because that's how that always works. It's not... Yep, question?
You said the upgrade was supported the last two releases?
It's the last release. So if you're running 5.3, you can upgrade to 5.4. If you're running 5.3, you could not upgrade to 5.5 without upgrading to 5.4 in between.
What about support? Is it the last two releases as well?
It's the last two releases only.
Okay.
So today it's 5.4 and 5.5. May 1st comes, 5.5 is released. All support for 5.3 goes away. And then you have 5.4. So in essence, they're supported for one full year. You have the 6 months where it is the current release, and then 6 months where it's the previous release. That's starting to change a little bit, not from the project itself. There's a company called MTier that does a lot of really good OpenBSD support stuff. You have to pay them the farther back you go, but they are starting to do binary patches and whatnot for older releases. So if I had brought the CD set, I would have hammered the OpenBSD equals quality mantra into your heads. Because I really do think that it's something that people really need to see to believe. You know, this is not, we print out some CDRs, throw them in a paper sleeve and mail them to you and forget about it. You know, every release, you know, there are people who go out of their way to design really professional artwork and record in a truly, you know, unique professional audio recording every single 6 month period. And the goal of quality permeates everything. You know, we have shirts, we have code, everything. It's that idea that we should do it the best way we know how. And that's what we strive for in everything. And OpenBSD is funded by you, really. This is not like a sales pitch where someone comes up and says, you know, we take donations, but on the other hand, you know, some huge company is really the one backing us. No, we have no corporate sponsors. You know, our project is funded on CD sales, and on sales of the t-shirts, the books, the posters. And yes, we do take donations if you are kind enough to give donations. And I have shown the donations list to people, both OpenBSD users who have been users for years and years and years, and people who have never used OpenBSD before. And everybody says the same thing. I cannot believe how long your donations lists are. I'm like, yeah, because people actually use OpenBSD as much as, you know, people may want to deny that. We have tons of users, and they are willing to help us out, which is great. And yes, definitely buy some t-shirts if you have time. They're fantastic. I wear them out all the time around the university that I'm at. My whole department, they may not know what OpenBSD is, but they all know Puffy, and they all love him. And people will actually talk to you. If you go up and you have one of those shirts, I get stopped all the time, and people ask, you know, what is that thing on your shirt? Like, that fish is a need. Where does that come from? And I've talked to so many interesting people around the university about OpenBSD just because I wear the shirts. So to quote Theo again in his recent EuroBSDCon talk, he says, maybe we're an operating system idea incubator organization. Basically, we incubate ideas. With the first operating system to ship IPsec, IPv6, crypto, SSH, strong random, stack protector, the list goes on and on and on. It comes down to ultimately, we're not afraid to break things in big ways, clean it all up, and then push the rest of the world on forward with us. And we are changing the world. And I'll give a brief example about what we're doing now a little later on. And that goes back to, you know, the fact that OpenBSD is for the developers, by the developers. Our users might complain, it's wonderful, we're moving on ahead, and we'll just drag them along too. So if you guys have not bought Michael Lucas's OpenBSD Second Edition, he explains in his preface about the OpenBSD community, he gives it four tiers: users, contributors, committers, and the coordinator. So I have a list too of what I call OpenBSD beneficiaries, people who benefit from the work that we do. It's the developers, what I call direct users, indirect users, and then the world. And I broke out my incredible GIMP skills to give you that bullseye target thing. They're supposed to be labels, but I really don't know how GIMP works, so I just left that as is. If anybody wants to teach me GIMP later, go for it. I'd be happy to learn. So, developers. Theo, he's our founder, he's the project lead, he founded OpenBSD in 1995. We have, give or take, about 80 active developers. We're the names that show up if you follow our source changes list and our port changes list, people who can actually make changes to the CVS tree. New developers are by invitation only, and if you ask for it, you won't get one. So don't ask. And like I said, it's for developers, by developers. Then we have our direct users. These are everybody else who can't commit to CVS, who are actually using OpenBSD on one of their machines. Whether it's a machine that they own personally, whether it's a company machine, this is what Michael Lucas calls our users. This is where, just by virtue of the fact that they're using OpenBSD, where our new developers generally come from. And it's really simple to become a developer. You send patches in, you send a lot of good patches, you get an invite. It's really easy. I did it. So, if you've never used OpenBSD, of course the question is, what does OpenBSD offer me? This one is my personal favorite reason for using OpenBSD. This is consistency. No matter which one of the 21 platforms you install OpenBSD on, the OS, it looks the same, it feels the same, and it behaves the same, which is fantastic. That's my current inventory of machines that I could think of off the top of my head. I have more. I have some in boxes that I've never even opened. And they're all different platforms, they're all different architectures. And I just do not have time to research a different OS for each one of my machines. Because I know people who do this. They'll use one version of one thing on their fast machines, they'll use something else entirely on a slow machine, they'll have a Mac powered PC where they don't know what the hell they're gonna run on because they can't find anything that runs on it anymore. I don't have that problem. I install OpenBSD and I have the same easy to use, easy to work with system. And it's a single, consistent, well-documented way to do everything. And it makes for easy prototyping. Yeah. If you already know how to install OpenBSD on your laptop, you know how to install OpenBSD on your BeagleBone. If you know how to install packages on your laptop, you already know how to install packages on whatever other architecture you want to use OpenBSD on. It's all the same. I joke about this with my friends, my patented method of OpenBSD installation, just to show you how easy it is. You boot the installer, you put a shot glass on the enter key, you grab yourself a drink, you come back, it's done. It's not quite that easy, but it's pretty damn close. Actually, for anybody here who watches the BSD Now program, today they actually did an install fest where they installed free, open, net, Dragonfly, and PCBSD. And the OpenBSD install, it took them all of 2 minutes, and they were done with it, and they never spoke about it again. PCBSD, VirtualBox crash, you know, they got their settings wrong on FreeBSD. So, you know, there's something nice about having something really simple that takes all of 5 minutes to install.
I just installed it in VirtualBox.
Yeah, and it was simple. It's a shell program.
Got it.
It asks you a bunch of questions. You press enter a bunch of times. You press W for you want to use your hold disk. A for auto format the hard drive.
I didn't have to hit W for hold disk. It was the default.
Oh, even better. Yeah. Because I install OpenBSD a whole lot, and I don't have the time to wait for a GUI to come up and an hour for my OS to install. Especially on the slower architectures, where it'll take a long time anyway, just because they're slow.
So you said you usually do a net install. So
yeah.
Can you give us an idea of like how big it is, how long it takes to download?
So a net install is really easy. After your first install of OpenBSD, usually people do this on the CDs, although you can pixie boot on AMD 64 and i386. Usually, if it's a totally fresh install that has nothing on the hard drive, I tend to use a CD, just because it's less headache, because I don't really have an easy way to do pixie boot at home.
When you say net install, when you said that you install from the internet, I have this idea of like similar to Debian's net install.
Yeah, it's quite similar. So the way the OpenBSD install works is you have a RAM disk. You boot the RAM disk, it asks you a bunch of questions, and this is where you want to install from. It gives you a list, CD, disk, NFS, HTTP, FTP. I just picked HTTP.
Yeah.
Nice boat runs a mirror.
Mm-hmm. Right,
it's
I mean,
quick.
My question is like how big it is, like how long it would.
How long does it take me to install on my laptop? 3 minutes tops, top to bottom. I'm talking about from the time it boots the RAM disk to the time I hit type of new boot. Three minutes tops.
With the download transfer.
With the download.
Cool.
So how do you get to that?
That's
how
what
do you
I was
put
asking.
RAM disk.
So the CDs have the RAM disk on them. So when you put the CD in, that's what it will boot from. For people who already have OpenBSD installed, the RAM disk is actually part of the install. So when it says boot, instead of just hitting enter, you type bsd.rd. And it takes care of everything for you.
So, like single user mode functionality.
Yeah. And we do everything from single use server to desktop. And this is part of, you know, when I was talking to people about this, it infuriated me that people would say, you know, they actually spend time in their day looking for a different OS install on every little computer there is. Because you could just use OpenBSD and do everything. And it scales well. You know, if you have a small little ARM box and all you want to do is run Tor, done. Install OpenBSD, package add Tor, plug it in, forget about it for the next 12 years. Well, it happily runs and you have Tor. You know, if you have an old Spark 64 box lying around, I did once, now I have two. You know, one of them is actually my home file server. You know, really easy. Everything that you need is in base, unless you really want Samba. And then again, it's just package add Samba, and you're done. Put your files on, enjoy it. You'll never worry about it again until the hard drive dies. This one's a popular one, old laptops for people. Yeah. OpenBSD, install whatever desktop environment you think, you know, mom or dad or whoever will be comfortable with, and you'll have to worry about it again. Or if you want some massive desktop, we have that too. We were the first BSD with GNOME 3, with updates. It's not like, you know, someone imported GNOME 3 and left it alone. Every 6 months, and this is Jasper and Antoine, and they do, really, all of these people do Herculean jobs with the support stuff. Every 6 months, you know, the new version of GNOME comes out, OpenBSD has it. And as the updates roll in through the life cycle of GNOME, we get the updates. KDE 4.11, we have a porting team for KDE. Zhook has been doing most of that with help from a lot of others. I think off the top of my head, SB, Natty, Landry, Antoine. XFCE 4.10, the latest one, it's there if you want it. Firefox is there. Actually, all of Mozilla is there. Firefox, Thunderbird, all that stuff. And Landry does all the Mozilla stuff in. If you see him, buy him a beer, because it's incredibly difficult. You know, all this stuff. You know, it's not easy to get these big things working on an OS, no matter what the OS is.
Is GIMP available?
Yes. That's how I made that lovely graphic. In fact, GIMP is available on the tiny little MIPS box. So if you really wanted to, you had the patience, you couldn't, you know, you could build, install, and run GIMP on my tiny little MIPS box. Which was really fun to actually try out. It was about, I want to say a month ago, a user submitted a patch that fixed something else that happened to be dependency on GIMP. And then LibreOffice, which of course I'm talking to you, showing you slides from. So all this stuff is there. You know, a lot of people like to complain, and I've had to field this more often than I would like to. People complaining about, oh, the BSDs don't have this, they don't have that. It's all, I know this is going to be recorded, bullshit. And it's really that simple. And you still get all the security and other benefits that OpenBSD gets you. You still get all the privilege separation, you get a WXRX, all that stuff. It doesn't go away just because you use third-party packages. It doesn't necessarily mean they're as secure, but it's better than not having those protections behind them. And then our indirect users. These are people who aren't using BSD, who aren't developers, but in some way are using some sub-project from OpenBSD. And OpenSSH is the big one. Is there anybody in this room who honestly does not use OpenSSH, or any SSH for that matter? Because if you're using SSH, it's OpenSSH. Anybody not use SSH? No, exactly. Everybody uses it. You have us to thank. And this actually is one of the things that infuriated me most. People do not know where OpenSSH comes from. It comes from OpenBSD. Tell all your friends, because they have no clue.
That's actually an interesting point. What is Dropbear? Is that a fork?
I've heard of Dropbear. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I have heard it's either dead or dying or discontinued. I don't actually, I've never had...
It's in the Mercedes, too. That's where I know it from.
But as far as I know, I've heard recently, and I could be totally wrong, that project is either falling towards the wayside or already has.
Well,
so
these guys dropped on December 3rd, 2013.
All right, I could be totally
so,
wrong.
Not dead.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'm going by third, you know, second, third-hand information. Because
I just Googled it.
Yeah. It's more work than I did. I'll give you that. So everybody uses OpenSSH, so everybody in this room benefits from OpenBSD existing. And I would argue that the entire world benefits from having OpenSSH existing. Because even if you know, they're not personally using OpenSSH, somebody who's running a computer that they absolutely depend on is running OpenSSH.
You know what's missing from that PF list?
What?
PF sense.
It is.
Love.
I thought the irony would be too great. I had that typed in. And I said, no.
No, you should have totally left it there.
Well, yes, pfSense is definitely one of the people who uses PF. So PF, for those of you who don't know, it's our packet filter, it's our firewall. Every BSD has PF on their system. I know FreeBSD has more than one firewall available.
Every Mac,
but
every iPhone.
Right. Every Apple computer and every iDevice has PF on it.
Every Mercedes.
Every BlackBerry has PF on it because QNX has PF. I'm not sure that every instance of QNX, because they also do you know, high-end routers and whatnot, if they have PF, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did. But I know BlackBerry for a fact because I've spoken to Henny and I've seen his slides. Henny and Reich actually did a great talk, VBSDCon back in October, and this stuff had come up in Henning's part of the talk. And then there's also Mandoc, and this is Ingo's baby. It's the new way to do man pages. Every BSD has Mandoc, so you're all benefiting from it already, if you don't know. It's designed to be a C replacement for the massive, bloated nonsense that is GROF, and it works well. It's actually designed to be a bug-for-bug compatible with GROF. So FreeBSD has it, NetBSD has it, Dragonfly has it, Minix has it, if anybody's using that. And there's at least one distro of Linux that has Mandoc available. So that's definitely coming if you're not using it yet. And then other things we have that you might use, Tmux, that's a quite popular terminal multiplexer. CWM, which I found out recently is hugely popular with the Arch Linux people. So there's a subreddit where all people do is post their screenshots of their Unix and Linux desktops. And literally 75% of the CWM users are Arch users. The other 25% are OpenBSD people. And I actually, for those of you who know Ocon, he's at this point kind of the primary maintainer of CWM. Although he does other things. He'd get mad at me if I didn't say that. I like to send him all the pictures. I'm like, oh, look, Ocon, look, more pretty CWM pictures. He gets a kick out of it. And then NG, which is a micro Emacs variant. For those of you who don't like to use the huge GNU Emacs. There are some ports of MG out there in the world. And then the world. So these are the people who have no idea that our devices run their code, probably have no idea what OpenBSD is, or any BSD for that matter, couldn't care less, or who in other you know, uses benefit from our work. You know, the big one, other than OpenSSH, is really PF. You know, anybody you know who has a Mac, or an iPhone, or an iPad, they're all using PF. They're all benefiting from the fact that OpenBSD is around, and there are people who are writing PF. So what's going on in OpenBSD now? So about, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, maybe, Theo wrote a big email about SterleCopy and SterleCat. For those of you who don't know what these are supposed to be safe, auditable replacements for string copy and string cat. Because what happened is, back in 96, there was a big audit of the source tree, and they found rampant misuse of SternCopy and SternCat, which were at the time being used as attempts to be safe replacements for string copy and string cat, and that didn't really work out all that well for a lot of different reasons. It shows up in OpenBSD. It's an OpenBSD invention, July 1st, 1998. If you're interested, OpenBSD, every developer who's ever giving a talk at a conference puts their papers on the website, papers.html. Go there. You can see Theo and Todd Miller's talk about SterleCopy, SterleCat, why they came up with it, you know, what challenge they were trying to solve. It's designed to provide an easier time writing and auditing string code to avoid overflows and truncations. Like any tool, no tool is perfect, but this is a hell of a lot better than doing string copy and string cat where you get no protections. You know, this will make your job in making safe code a hell of a lot easier. Okay, so you might be thinking, who actually uses this stuff? After all, it's an OpenBSD invention. This is a short list, totally taken at random, of things that use SterleCopy and SterleCat. Things you probably have never heard of, like the Linux kernel, like Mac OS X and iOS, like every BSD that's out there, even Solaris, CF Engine, Chromium, you know, ClamAV, CUPS, glib2. So you think everything that, you know, links against glib2 has SterleCat and SterleCopy available to them. LibEvent, so if you use tmux, you're using it. Mono, the C-sharp stuff. Mozilla, Perl. You know, this list goes on and on and on. And Theo actually went out of his way to, with the help of Stuart Henderson, list every single piece of code in our porch tree that uses SterleCat and SterleCopy. Not all of them are upstreamed in looking at which ones I wanted to choose for this. It turns out that we actually passed some of ours to upstream, hasn't yet accepted these changes. Hopefully they will, because it makes everybody safer. And the one I picked for Ike is ZFS, because I know how much you like ZFS. SterleCopy, SterleCat's in there. It's in X. So you pretty much can't use a Unix or a Linux machine these days without using these functions. And there are tons more examples. If you go to that link, that's Theo's long email with everything included in it. And that brings us to recent months with the security theater nonsense with, you know, Snowden, the NSA leaks, the GCHQ in the UK. Another 30C3 talk. This is pointed out to me. Take this with an extreme grain of salt because I do. And Jacob Applebaum's talk to protect and infect. He puts up a slide for something called Swap, which replaces the host protected area of the hard drive, which allows basically backdoor access to the machine no matter what OS you're running. His graphic list that the targets are Windows, Linux, FreeBSD, and Solaris. So does that mean it's not targeted for OpenBSD? You know, I wouldn't, you know, hang my hat on that. But, you know, it does show that, you know, security problems are out there no matter what you're using, and that it makes sense to use something that is built with security in mind. And like I said before, RC4, if it's crackable, if the NSA reports are true, we've already moved the Cha-Cha 20. We've already gotten rid of it. So you're already safe. And then the future. So two parts, the future's now, the future's coming. So what's going on now? Between 5.4 and current, we're dropping a lot of old compatibility headers, notably sgtty.h and systimed.h, among others. Our libcompat is gone. So if you still have code out there that was written in the 1980s, I'm not going to work on 5.5. And I can't imagine that it would be safe to run anyway these days. so don't do it. Radeon KMS, graphics for the ATI cards, shows up in August 11th. That's the whole commit, you can see. It's available today in current. It will be in 5.5. If you have an Intel graphics card, we already support that in 5.4. But of course, improvements, you know, as improvements always happen, will be in current. If you have an ATI card, AMD card, you will download the firmware for it on first boot. And it works with all the cards through and including the HD 6000 series. And of course, work is always being done on moving forward. Hopefully, because AMD just went through a large open source in a lot of their drivers and cards, that this work will be easier in the future. We also have an auto installer that's coming as well, October 27th, that hits the tree. There's actually a call for testing for it right now. So if anybody out there uses OpenBSD, is interested in doing automated installs, now is the time to test. Basically, it is the install program as it always is. You give it a little, essentially, question and answer sheet. It reads the question and answer sheet, fills in everything for you. It's still a work in progress, like I said. Call for testing is now. If you go to undeadly.org, that's the OpenBSD journal, that's where the call for testing is. And this is the big one. 64-bit long time T. August 13th, 2013. We switch time T, INO T, clock T, and instruct K events, I events, and data members to 64-bit types. This is huge because this broke everything. And we even built Perl with big time. So the way it was before was, you know, time 32-bit number, in 2038, it flips, and a whole bunch of problems happen. So now every architecture in OpenBSD, whether it's 32-bit or 64-bit, is using long for time T. So they're always guaranteed to be 64 bits. So it means you will never, ever, ever have to worry about a time problem again, just because of how big 64-bit numbers are. However, we were not the first ones to move to 64-bit time T, as I learned. NetBSD actually did it first, but the one thing NetBSD didn't do is they didn't engage any of their port upstreams. So if their ports broke, it was just, okay, sad day for NetBSD users. There's no way you're going to make the world a better place if you're doing it in a vacuum and not engaging with anybody else. It's just not going to happen. So 64-bit time T on OpenBSD is available today on current. It will be in 5.5. We will provide a safe update method for 5.5 because of how huge this change is. So you don't have to worry about that. Like I said, it's long, so guaranteed to be 64 bits on every single architecture. And this really comes in two broad steps. There's the base, making sure OpenBSD works with long time T, and then ports. And ports is important too. And this is where, you know, NetBSD didn't go. You need to contact your ports and do it for them as well, because if you expect your programs to continue to work, they're not going to work. And 2038 is coming whether we want it to or not. You know, at some point, they're going to have to change. So they might as well change now. And that way, it's done with. We don't have to worry about it. Because even though today is not 2038, today is 2014. If you do future planning, if you do embedded systems, which a lot of them today are still 32-bit and will be 32-bit in the future, you know, do you really want to deploy something in 2020 or 2025 with a 15-year time frame for life and have 2038 hit in the middle or towards the end of its life where it's still expected to work? And all of a sudden, it doesn't work anymore. That's going to be a huge problem. The one Theo talked about was pacemakers. Could you imagine having a pacemaker and then having to get a call in 2037 saying you need to come for surgery now so you can replace the firmware with the software on your pacemaker? Lucas also uses
that. Did you miss Y2K or something?
We're not going to talk about how old I was in Y2K. Another thing that is big that a lot of users have been asking for is signed packages, signed binaries. It's finally coming, New Year's Eve. No one knows how to pronounce this yet. On BSD now, I think they called it Signify. I'm going to go with Signify, because Signify is actually a word. So Ted Yu adds this, as Signify, a tool to sign and verify signatures. Like I said before, ManPage is part of the import. It will be used to sign packages soon, hopefully really soon. And the base system will be less soon, but it will be coming. I'm not 100% sure that this will make 5.4, 5.5, just because where we are in the whole process of doing everything. I hope it does. I hope I'm wrong about that. But if not, you know, 5.6 is more than enough time, I think. So let's say you want to start...
It's actually in current right now.
It is in current today, yes. If you pull down sources today, or you install today's snapshot, it's already there. So you can play with it if you want. Yeah, as George runs off to go play with it and ignores everything else. So let's say you want to start your own OpenBSD adventure. You're new. Where do you start? Well, for one, run OpenBSD. I cannot tell you how many times that sentence is not obvious to people. Run OpenBSD. I probably get asked once every week, once every 2 weeks at the longest gap, you know, how do I get started with OpenBSD? My first question is always, are you running OpenBSD? And it's always no. Well, there's no other way to get started but by running it. So do that. Join our mailing list. I would say MISC is definitely what you want to join because that's where all the talk comes in. If you're interested in doing ports work, ports. If you're interested in doing work on the base and kernel, it's tech. If you really, really like us so much that you want to track every single port, every single CVS commit, you have source changes for base and the website and port changes for ports, then read the mailing list. Because really, there are archives everywhere. Like, there's at least 3 copies of the archives that I can think of off the top of my head. You do not want to be the person who asked the same question that's been answered in the last week 100 times. This is why people think we're mean. We're not mean. It's that you can only answer the same question so many times before it starts to, you know, grate on you. And given the choice between writing new code and looking up a link that somebody else should have looked up, I'm probably going to prefer writing new code because it's a better use of my time. Read the FAQ, read the man pages. They are amazing. I can't stress that enough. They are incredible, and it's a ton of work, and those people have my utmost respect for those who actually do that work, because I could not do that work, no way. And like I said before, the errors in documentation are bugs. So if you see something wrong, even if it's a typo, write up a pat, send it in, we're more than happy to commit it. So let's say you want to get involved, because this is another question I get all the time. Do everything from the previous slide. Run OpenBSD, use it, join the mailing list, read everything. Then you're going to use OpenBSD some more. Over time, you will find stuff that you want to improve. Improve them, and then send in your patches. You know, this was my story. It's really simple. It's one sentence. I had a MIPS laptop and a desire to use it. That's how I got my start. So if anyone is a new user, I have a challenge for you. If you haven't even the slightest inkling of using OpenBSD from this talk, go home, install on any of your machines. In 2 weeks' time, send in a patch. Blame me for it. You can blame me for it. Say I told you to. It could be anything. It could be a typo in the man page on the website. It could be a port update. And there are thousands of ports, and there are thousands of ports that aren't being maintained. And there's lots of tiny ones that we would really appreciate if someone just stepped up and said, you know, this comes out once every 4 months. I'll crank the number and send in a patch. Like, that would be amazingly helpful. Or maybe you want to do something more substantial and do something in base or the kernel. So, just to recap everything, OpenBSD and you in 2014. A consistent, security-minded OS that is literally future-proofing the world. Technologies that you're probably using today, even if you didn't know that they were from OpenBSD before. You write better code because you have good documentation. And if you really, really want, you can actually have that kick-ass firewall. Questions?
One for the installer.
Yeah.
Embedded systems. There used to be stuff floating around. A guy named Chris Cappuccino had scripts for building. So what?
Cappuccio.
Sorry. Yeah. Oops. what is it? He had scripts that were basically for building an image that
Flash.
Was appropriate for a Sopress box or something.
You talking about Flash RD?
Yeah, Flash RD. Yeah.
That stuff is still there.
Is that in OpenBSD?
It's in. I know his network shell is in ports. I don't remember offhand if Flash RD is in ports. It might be. I know his N shell is definitely in ports.
People still use it.
Yeah, he actually gave a talk I want to say, what, last year, 2013, with Will on BSD Talk, all about NSHN Flash ID.
Cool.
And I'm almost, I am positive that he gave a talk about it at where he is at, you know, an event like this. So that stuff is still out there if you want to use it. Now, that comes with the caveat of it's his, you know, his stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And the author. In the back?
Are you going to import, like, the Beehive hypervisor from BSD, or are you guys looking at any sort of beyond the current hypervisor in the future?
The short answer is no. The long answer is we have a long history with virtualization, and, you know, we build everything natively. You know, we don't take virtual machines, you know. That's probably, if it comes, a very far future event.
I just don't.
So you mentioned you weren't, that OpenBSD doesn't generally take any GPLv3 code at all.
Correct.
And I was just curious, I don't know if you do a lot of licensing stuff, but what kind of the rationale would be for that versus like V2, like what are kind of the things that are, that OpenBSD sees as problematic with 3?
So I'm not a lawyer, and I really can't speak for the project as a whole on why we don't take GPLv3. That would really be a question for Theo. It's just historically we haven't, and you know, that does show up in our code. We are still using GCC, you know, 4.1.2. I'm sure it's because the licensing is much more restrictive than the GPLv2, and it might cause OpenBSD to have to be licensed as a whole as GPLv3, and we really need to avoid that at all costs. We know with GPLv2, if we have code in there, we don't need to license OpenBSD as a whole as GPLv2. So that, while not wonderful, is at least safe. Now, and in our tree, there's a directory called GNU, which is where all the GPL stuff lives. So it's in a separate directory, isolated from everything else as well. So you can actually build OpenBSD without it. I mean, you won't get Perl, you won't get your compiler tools, but you could do it.
I had a question on building and ports and packages.
Go for it.
From the perspective of like you know, an internet company with servers, right? And a, say, a web stack that is the product that the company really, you know, makes its money with. And the life cycle of that web stack doesn't necessarily always follow a particular port or a particular version of software. Things can get very old, things can be very bleeding edge, and they could all be very much, these old and bleeding edge things could all have to coexist on the same server and the same application stack, right? What's the OpenBSD approach to this, seeing as there's, it's really all about this entirely integrated thing? So if I've got a version of Foo, you know, software package or library that is completely going to break our web application stack, how do I proceed with OpenBSD?
Do you know what version of OpenBSD that the library that will break everything last ran on? Because usually it ends up being, you know, you run something older until you can get, you know, that newer software to catch up and actually use a modern library. And the way we work is we do all of our ports on our current tree. So once a release hits, once we cut a release, everything that's in packages is just in packages. And the packages never change.
What about, is there a mentality about building packages or, and creating your own package repositories to help manage some of this chaos? Or is that like a, like, I don't know what the scene is.
I mean, sure, if you want to take your own tree and build everything yourself, no one's going to stop you. No one's going to offer you help if you break everything, because we're going to expect that you are running on current and running what is in our port tree.
Why,
but there's no one going to stop you.
Why would you build your own packages?
In order to maintain
the library?
The library or the older software, or and also to make it coexist with some of the maybe newer software that's also got to run with it on the same box. I mean, this to me is a kind of a common web application stack integration problem these days. Like the stacks get very large, and the product life cycle of an internet company is wonderful as the release cycle is of OpenBSD. I'm going to tell you right now that pretty much don't line up, right? You know, it's not a thing that any business wants to do, to have to, say, rewrite some huge chunk of code that's going to break because your foundation is changing, right?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, if you like what you have, you should stick to it. You know, you install OpenBSD, you know, and, you know, the security stuff, you know, doesn't go away even if you're using an older version of OpenBSD, you know. I know plenty of people who are using horribly old and outdated versions of OpenBSD. But it runs, you know, they run forever if you don't touch them. And they'll never give you a problem. I mean, sure, you won't have whatever the newest thing is, but you can still be, you know, you can feel safe at night going to bed that you have a secure system that's up, even if it is old.
Great talk, brother. Thank you very much, Brian. I'm mostly a FreeBSD guy, but the last couple of years, last 5 years or so, every time I've tried to run FreeBSD on a laptop, I think I've gone through 4 or 5 of them. Something always breaks, suspend, hibernate, Wi-Fi, something like that. And I think it has to do with a lot of the FreeBSD devs. They mostly use macOS laptops. I know the OpenBSD guys definitely use OpenBSD on their own laptops. How supported is it? I mean, in terms of, really, the only thing that really bugs me is like suspend and hibernate, the wireless support. If OpenBSD had it, I would jump to it in a second, because I currently run one too.
So, you know, as everything, the caveat, of course, is it depends on the model and the way your laptop feels on that particular day, whether or not you get things like suspend and resume. But in general, if you use stuff that a lot of developers have, I use ThinkPads. They work excellently. I can do whatever I want with them, and it'll just do it, which is really nice. Support and more support is always being worked on, is always being tested. So even if something isn't supported today, you know, somebody's probably working on it, and it'll hopefully be supported tomorrow. But we have, I would say, of the BSDs, and I don't want to brag, because I'm sure people will rain down on me for saying this, but we probably have the best. You know, and probably the best by a long margin.
You mean laptops?
Right.
Right.
The only thing you will not get, and that you will never get, is the binary blob for NVIDIA. So if you have an NVIDIA laptop, and I've been telling this to people because I have a bunch of people who I know who run OpenBSD on their laptops that have NVIDIA cards. I'm like, Nouveau has a MIT license. You already have all the hard stuff, the KMS, the DRM stuff. That's already in there. Just port Nouveau. I have like 8 people independently who have asked me, who have told me they're going to port Nouveau. And I hope one of them is listening and will actually start doing it, because it'd be fantastic. Because then at least we can say, you know, you're not going to get the supported in quotes, blob from NVIDIA. But you won't be using Visa anymore. Because at the moment, the answer really is for that, you know, don't buy NVIDIA. And that's a pretty common OpenBSD thing anyway. But going back to your question, suspend and resume, a lot of laptops are headed free or really close. Wi-Fi, again, is also, you know, depends on what's in there. Some manufacturers are better than others. I have an Intel one in here. It works fine. Actually, got an improvement a couple of weeks ago, and now I don't even notice it anymore, which is fantastic.
A lot of
Wi-Fi cards require firmware that we can't distribute as part of our install. So what happens is we have a program called FW_update. It gets run automatically on your first boot, although you can call if you really want to later on. It's essentially patchpad, so it treats it like any other package would. Right now, that will change a little bit when Signify comes out. That it'll grab it for you. So the downside for that is, if you want to do this all over Wi-Fi, and it has firmware, you got to get a way to get it into the RAM disk before you start the install. I can tell you that on my Limo, the little MIPS laptop I have, it actually has a Wi-Fi card that doesn't require any firmware. So I can, with no headache and without any, you know, manual work, do a Wi-Fi install on that machine. On this machine, I would need to get the firmware into the RAM, recognized by the RAM disk first, and then I could do Wi-Fi. It can be done, it's just more steps. So unfortunately for these, I generally tell people, you know, just plug it in when you're installing.
So Sorry, maybe you can explain the difference between a binary blob and firmware. Because when you're speaking in the negative of what you didn't want, you call it a binary blob. But then you're talking about binaries with the Wi-Fi cards, you're calling them firmware.
So binary blobs are things that run on your host CPU. They run on the Intel or AMD chip that you have. Firmware runs on the card, on a little USB stick. We would love to distribute the. We would love to be able to distribute the firmware for everything. Unfortunately, a lot of manufacturers give us a hard time with doing that. So that actually be something that, if people are interested in doing as a coordinated effort, is to write to some of these manufacturers and just ask them. We're not asking them for the code. We're only asking them to give a license that would let us distribute them on our CDs.
But that firmware is also binary that you cannot expect for. You know,
right. Correct. But it's not running on the host CPU. And I would tell you, buy a better Wi-Fi. There's always that too. Unfortunately, we're the little guy who don't have tons of buying power. But if we could come up with a coordinated effort to buy stuff that was firmware free, we would get it. It would take time, but it would happen.
The Theros cards are really cheap.
Yeah. Exactly.
Rock.
Yeah,
yeah.
Unless you have a BIOS that's locked to certain.
Yeah, like this one. Unbelievable pain. I can only run Intel cards on this. It's such a pain in the ass.
You brought up the issue before about virtualization, and I think there's a couple angles on that. The initial argument against doing it from a lot of the old BSD devs that I read was very much that virtualization, especially for the purposes of security, for instance, or in the context of security modeling, people tend to forget that the actually underlying architecture gets exaggerated in its vulnerability by virtualizing a system, and there's that mentality. But I do think, actually, that there is a strong, strong case for support of it, not just for the sake of it or not for doing whatever, but it tends to get dropped because we are in virtualization land, like it or not. Beehive is actually an example of what, from what I've seen and read and what I've heard from people I know doing, it makes sense as a direction for virtualization. It's not just a game-ish approach, and NetApp people, I guess, in particular, throwing code back into FreeBSD on it. But it's got to be understood, and I'm sure you do use virtual, you're talking about mocking virtualization support, but you do actually use it quite a lot. As a dev, number one, for dev environments and testing.
Are you sure you want to say that I use it a lot?
You do use it, right? I mean,
no. Okay. I don't use a single virtual machine software at all.
Next time you give advice to someone else about it, then I'll do it.
QMU, I know, is in course, but I don't use it.
So that's number one. But there's another case where I never thought about this at all, because until actually people hammered this on my door, but people actually care about virtualization offerings as from providers, believe it or not. So a lot of people bring this up. You brought this up to me also. A lot of people look for, like, who? Oh, this. I'm looking for an ISP that does virtualization images for OpenBSD or FreeBSD or whatever. And to a large layer of people in the world, that actually matters. For different reasons. It's like, oh, they have a Linux, I'll just use a Linux. And it becomes almost a default answer for people who are looking for what a provider does. I'd rather get a $20 a month VM than pay $100 a month for Colo a box and worry about hardware, right? So, I actually...
A VM at home.
I'm sorry?
A VM at home, Linux, open VM, Windows VM. We could use the approach of, jails.
So to me, just to kind of concur with what your point is, I mean, I think a lot of us in the beginning were like, "Puh." I mean, we had a meeting on Zen in like 2005, and everybody was thinking about like production environment stuff. But yes, there's the hosting thing, but I also think something more substantial.
2 week challenge. It's 2 weeks to run a nice, safe VM container for us.
I'm gonna call it SysGL. Just kidding. All right.
But no, I mean, if that's something that you want to, to see happen,
OpenGL.
Start it, Doesn't mean that you have to write the code yourself, but, get people interested in doing it in a smart, safe, secure way. And if it's good, it'll make it in eventually.
bitches.
Eventually. Maybe in ports. Anybody else?
Have you heard about anybody running Google Authentic Code with OpenBSD, with OpenSSH and OpenBSD?
Google what?
Authentic Code. It's basically, you know, little RSA keys to generate random 16 numbers. It's something you can download from Google for free on your iPhone or your Android or whatever, BlackBerry, and it will generate those numbers.
There is YubiKey
there,
support.
We have YubiKey support. In base.
YubiKey.
Oh, okay.
But there is open one-time pad OTP support.
Yeah.
I OTP support stuff, so.
Yeah, the little YubiKeys, you know.
What's
the cheap? They're like $25.
What's the name of that one for?
Google Authentic Code.
I know the thing, yeah.
You can download it from Google for free, and they have libraries that have to compile into OpenSSH. Right? They have it, you can compile into Linux, and then the question is support an OpenBSD.
Just go back to the virtual machine just really quick, because it's just something that I thought of. Recently, we got support running as a guest in Google's Execute Engine. Is that what it's called? I think that's what it's called. So guest support is there. You know, if you want to run it as a guest, like, that's not an issue. The hosting side is, you know, obviously more of an issue.
It's not like, you know, I guess the hosting side is
more important.
Right. The thing with the YubiKey, you got to carry it around. Where almost everybody carries a cell phone these days, and
right.
A smartphone.
So it's a Google app that sits on a Android or whatever.
On your phone
or iPhone or BlackBerry. Or
right, for one-time key, S key.
And there's a Firefox thing. So that's free. So you can get the thing for free. But you need something on the OpenSSH server side to let you in. It's got to ask for your username, your password, and your one-time key.
I don't know about it. Doesn't mean it's not there. It's just it's not something that I use. It's not even something I've even heard of. So,
well,
I'll definitely check that
support
out.
Some kind of OTP, S key,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But the hardware.
Let me say, it's an OpenBSD kind of thing, right? It's security. Yeah. It's extra two-factor authentication for your secure box.
But it's Google.
I mean,
Google gives you the code. I remember, to give you the source,
a couple years ago, adding LDAP authentication for SSH. It wasn't really that bad, so.
Yeah, people have written DNSSEC.
It's not
similar things with DNSSEC to use that for auth with OpenSSH.
It's
okay.
Authentic code?
Yeah, Google Authentic Code, Google.
Well, I have it, it's not coming.
It's like Google. It was a one-time Google product. Like, yes, they pull it without warning, and they get rid of everything.
Microsoft,
like, it never existed.
Authentic Code.
Amazon does the same thing. But I've never found the library.
Oh, Google Authenticator, I guess. Google Authenticator.
Right. Google, on a wild goose chase to find this stuff. Find it, George?
Yes.
My understanding
yes.
of that was that it only works with Google services, though. It has,
right.
it, my understanding was that it only works with Google services.
It definitely does not only
work
with
Google
services.
Right.
It works
by
default with Google services, but they give you the,
but it has,
the library code you can compile and edit into OpenSSH. So then anything you can link it into OpenSSH will use it. And they have a thing all set up for Linux.
I know.
So OpenBSD would probably take a little more work.
I'd love to see a patch for it.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
If that's not there and that's something you want, absolutely write up a patch. Yeah. That's the way things get done around here. You know, write up something. Things don't just come out of thin air. Someone's actually got to do the work.
Right.
Any other questions?
Someone did do the work.
Somebody did do the work?
_ Google auth. Google two-factor authentication for OpenBSD.
There you go. You don't even have to do the work. It's already there.
Trigger heavy.
Is it in the ports or is it a patch? You know?
It wouldn't be in ports, so it would be part of SSH.
Would it be?
I'd assume so.
It's code that you can download from this dude.
Well, that makes me feel really safe. It's this dude who has code that he can download. Oh, that's even better. Now I really trust him.
Yeah, this.
I know he's male.
His GPG signatures now. But just download the code from this dude.
It's only safe to trust a dude to send you a really snazzy CD. When you download from some dude.
Three CDs.
With
the
song.
If you buy from us.
With the song.
With the song. And on the second CD, it's the uncompressed version of the song. Even better.
So I did have a real question that I came up with somewhere in the beginning. You said that you have support for ARM7.
Yes. In 5.4, it's called Beagle. After 5.4, we changed the name of it to ARMv7 because now we do more than just Beagle.
So does that mean... Because I'm not really familiar with the difference between the ARM instruction sets. Does that mean that there is no support for... The Raspberry Pi?
No, we do not have support for Raspberry Pi because the way the Raspberry Pi works, it's not even the architecture. The way the Pi works is... Hang on, let me back up and I think it'll answer your question. So the way the Pi works is the GPU is one big massive blob that is also your bootloader. It bootstraps the CPU. So since we can't actually talk to the GPU, we can't get the CPU up. So it's like a non-starter. It's way too close, and nobody in the OpenBSD team really wants to do it.
I'm glad I got a Beagle Bone.
Beagle Bones are good. Those work. Panda boards work. Cube boards work. I'm not an ARM person, so I have no idea what the hell the difference between those three things are. I just know their names.
And the other idea I had was giving my Socris 4801 something to do now with this. As far as Socris support?
Support, that's awesome. Alex boards, all that's awesome.
Highly supportive.
Okay. We all started with Socris boxes with OpenBSD in 2004 here.
Yeah, you plug it in, you forget about it. Yeah. The hardware will die before you have a problem with it. You know, that's kind of the way it runs.
That's pretty good.
Question?
So when you say plug it in and forget about it, are you...
I literally mean you'll never have to worry about it again.
But are you running updates to get, like, security patches and stuff? Is that automatic?
Security updates are not automatic. You have to do them yourself. So there are two official supported ways. One is essentially more recommended than the other. So the install and the update program are identical. It's bsd.rd, it's that frame disk. Instead of choosing install, you choose update or upgrade. If you go from point-to-point releases, it just takes care of everything for you. You reboot, and you type package add. Package add with the new flag, and it'll do all your packages for you, and then you're done. So we're talking 10 minutes downtime at the most, and most of that's going to be trying to pull stuff off the internet. You could also, if you really wanted to, because all OpenBSD is essentially it's a bunch of tarballs that you extract into your file system, you could extract tarballs over what you currently have. It's technically supported, but we really encourage people to use the bsd.rd method, just because it will save you the headache in case something goes wrong. And there's an upgrade.html that you can, there's very detailed instructions like everything else to walk you through if you're unfamiliar.
I just installed OpenBSD without NX, and then I downloaded ports.
Ports will not work unless you have the XSets installed. Because it's too much of a pain in the ass to deal with people who don't have xlibs. You know, even if you install something that you don't think is linked to X, some library depends on probably links to X.
Bash?
You could probably install the libraries now.
You can install patches on top. That's not a problem.
You could probably build all the ports without the X server patches. Only X libraries. There should be
right.
Separate packages.
Right. You definitely need the libraries because. Well, depends how much of a jump you're doing. You know, if you're 5 years, you pretty much suck reinstalling because you really want to do 10 year all days. Yeah. So the short answer is put the xlibs on because Porch expects them, and it's just you could do it if you really wanted to, but you have to find every single package that you could possibly want to build that links to X and then patch out linking X, which is so much trouble. And we're really talking about, 10, 20 megabytes? Who doesn't have 10, 20 megabytes to spare these days?
Yeah,
Okay, so I promise this is not heckling, because I've talked to you about this before. But
Ike, for those of you who don't know, has admitted to being an OpenBSD heckler. Developer heckler, I should say.
Yes, yes.
That's some preface.
K-Shell.
What about it?
Well, is there a Bornish POSIX shell in there somewhere? And
K-Shell is a Bornish POSIX shell.
That's a package.
You can install the AT&T version of KSH if you really want it.
PDKSH.
That's what we have.
You've got
PDKSH. Okay. Dash is a package.
Yeah,
Dash
is a package. You can install Dash if you want, the Debian Almquist shell.
Okay, I'm sure.
You can install,
okay,
if you really want
let
to, you can install
this.
The Thomson V6 shell. We have a port of that too.
Let me ask this though, then what is, why was the K-shell chosen? And I don't mean that in a combative way, I mean that in a real, genuine,
real
like,
genuine way.
Is there a good reason to
yes, it is licensed in public domain. Fine, you know, Dash is not. Dash is not. Those are GPL. As a last resort, and not version 3. So when you have also a perfectly public domain shell, yeah, that's a pretty good option.
I will use OpenBSD.
But if you want that stuff, you know, that stuff is in packages. If that's something that you absolutely can't live without. And it might be. It's not for me.
I can't live without Bash.
I use K-Shell. Maybe it's just because I got used to it after all these years that I stopped worrying about it. Just, you know, it's like Dr. Strangelove, you know. How do I just stop worrying and love the KSH?
So you've mentioned packages and ports. So is it kind of like you've got main, and then you've got some packages, and then you've got ports?
So packages and ports are two ways of doing the same thing. When you build a port, what you're actually doing is building a package. That package head then turns around and installs, as if you got a package from somebody else, and then use package head to install. So all ports is really doing is adding the layer of compilation to make a package that package head, the same tool that will install packages no matter where you get them from, will then go ahead and install.
So package is a binary thing?
Yeah, so packages are the binaries, ports are the make files that will pull down the source code and build everything for you. And all that stuff is, you know, it's automated. You know, if you really want to build by ports, which if you're running super bleeding edge current, in which there's no current packet set up yet, you're never forced to build ports on release, and it's just a waste of your time if you're doing. Unless you really, really need something that, you know, has some sort of other set of flags. And I suggest that you actually look at the package beforehand, because a lot of things have what we call flavors. Like, I'll take Emacs as an example, because it's the first one that came to the top of my head. You know, you have the GTK 3 version, GTK 2 version, the NoX version, you know, or you can still build with the Athena toolkit, which I don't even think people use anymore. But that option's there if you want it. So that would be my suggestion, that you check the packets first to make sure it doesn't have a flavor that you want, because maybe that's all you really need. But if it turns out that you really need something that we don't offer, you could in fact install the port tree. The port tree actually will come, there's a tarball that you can just extract into user ports, and it'll have you give you the entire tree for that release. Yes. But yes, packages and ports are basically the same way of doing, two different ways of doing the same thing. And it's all managed under one tool, which saves all the headache in the world. Because you're not technically managing ports, you're just managing your packages, no matter where they come from.
There's also something very significant, like in FreeBSD, the ports are generally version-wise ahead of the packages. So you could actually install a package in FreeBSD and it'll have vulnerabilities, known vulnerabilities, or it hasn't been updated in a long time, or whatever. And there's a huge lag between the two. However, with OpenBSD, since I touched OpenBSD from the very beginning, it was always encouraged not to use ports, but rather to stick to packages.
Yes, and that's especially true for the releases, because we've already done all the work for you. And that's one of the things that we kind of pride ourselves on, is when we release a new version of OpenBSD, it's not just the base. It is packages for every single architecture. Talking about VAX2, you know, all that stuff. Already has packages ready to go. Now, the number of packages will be different for architectures because Some are using GCC 3 still, you know, some things only work on in x86, you know, because it has assembly in them or what have you. But they're there, they're ready to go on release day. So unless you are a ports developer or someone who wants to get started doing that work, you really don't have much of an incentive to install the ports tree.
I think there's some ports that aren't in packages. If ports is a larger set.
So
if you need a port that's not in a package.
Yes, there are some due to licensing issues that won't be there, and then you'll be forced to build the port. But
if you really want that, you gotta build the port.
If you really want that, you need the port. There's not that many of them though that are that way. There are more that will not come on CD that we have on FTP, but there might be one or two total that are only in the port tree that absolutely could not be redistributed on the FTP server. Maybe one or two. The fact that I can't think of them offhand means there might not even be any. Which is different than what comes on CD. You know, we have, not that we can include everything on CD because we don't, but we actually mark things that could be included on CD and the things that we could only distribute via FTP. But like 100% of users are installing packages through FTP anyway. So as long as that's where they can be found, everybody can get them.
You know, Fred, it's just my personal experience. I hate to keep interrupting. But for years, I mean, from forever with FreeBSD, I've always hacked on in the ports. I've changed the port versions. I've made packages. I've done all these things for years and years and years. I mean, just with like one example, a laptop that it started to run like 6 months ago, 9 months ago, whatever. I was like, oh my God, how could I live without a ports tree on here? And you know what? I'm happily living without a ports tree. I mean, it just, I got so used to playing with ports trees in FreeBSD all the time and updating and playing and hacking around, you know, with configurations and the makefiles all the time. And it's like, I don't need to and I shouldn't need to. You know, it's like, I'm fine with not doing it, you know?
We do the work so you don't have to. And it's a lot of work. And you don't want to have to. Trust me. Anything else? All right, so if you want to reach me, if you can think of questions, comments, flames, occasional encouragement, that's my email address. That's my OpenBSD email address. If anyone's on app.net, which is a social networking site, I'm at bcalat there. You can always reach me there. I get on my phone, so you get answers right away. To the bar.